water a human right or a commodity? We will look at water issues in Canada and Bolivia in three interviews. First, an interview with Anil Naidu of the Council of Canadians. I spoke to Anil on February 15th. Can you begin by introducing yourself and the work that you do?
Yes, I'm the director of the Blue Planet Project, which is the international water campaign of the Council of Canadians. We look at global water issues and particularly the human right to water, and we are actively working with grassroots organizations around the world to create and facilitate a global water justice movement.
Let's start off by discussing water as a human right. Why is that something important to say, and what does that mean?
Well, we believe that if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations, it does not explicitly include water, and that's because it was written some 50 years ago, and at that time, water was not under the same kind of threat that it is now. So it is implied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the same way as there is the right to life. We believe that there is the right to water. There does exist this right, but because it was not written explicitly in those documents at that time, it seems that some corporations and even some governments have taken liberties with this right and are in the process of commodifying and privatizing much of the world's water.
You talk about the commodification of water. When did this concept of water as a commodity arise?
Well, I think that it's probably been around longer than we recognize, because there's been many times, of course, when people would sell water, and that is essentially and profit from water, and that's essentially a commodification of it. But it has not been done on a large scale until more recently, when some of the large, primarily European multinationals, transnationals, have been actively going into the global south and even northern countries to control and privatize water and create markets, water markets, and profit from the world's water. This is something more recent. It's probably come about as a result of some of the international trade agreements that enshrine this type of thinking, the neoconservative and neoliberal ideologies of so-called free markets. These are the tools, combined with international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, which push countries and communities into the privatization of their water.
One of your campaigns at the Council of Canadians is to have water included in the Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations. Can you describe what is the situation of this campaign and what is Canada's position?
Well, Canada's position is very interesting because contrary to, I think, the will of the vast majority of Canadians, Canada has played a blocking role at the UN Commission on Human Rights. It has been the only country, 2 years in a row, out of the 53 countries that sit on that commission, to vote against the right to water. Essentially, they've been blocking what most Canadians feel is a very clear fundamental human right. Our country doing that, our government doing that, would be shocking to most Canadians. What it's done is Canada playing that role when normally Canada would play a very clear moral role on these human rights issues. It's set back our campaign quite dramatically. We have to overcome our own government's intransigence on this, and we are trying to work with other governments and with the global water activists to get a framework within the UN, a convention, a treaty on water as human right, as well as amend what we think is an unfortunate omission from the Declaration of Human Rights to include water. This is a long-term campaign because the issue of water globally is very loaded. There are many powerful interests who all have the ears of governments who are against the idea of water as a human right and against water being taken out of the global marketplace. They very much enjoy the fact that increasingly water is seen in some areas as a commodity, and they are certainly profiting from that realization.
The people of Uruguay recently voted to have water included in their constitution as a human right. Can you explain the significance of this move?
We think it's profoundly significant. For many years in this struggle, the Latin American countries have been leading the way, from Cochabamba, certainly to other struggles in Central America, and now Uruguay, where on October 31st of 2004, last year, the people of Uruguay changed their constitution in a democratic vote, and in that they very clearly stated in this constitutional amendment that water is a human right. The implications for this in the region we're already seeing, because Argentina, there is now a campaign in Argentina to similarly amend their constitution. We are in the process of working with our friends in Uruguay to expand this model and look at other countries around the world where we can similarly affect constitutional change and also legal change. We're working certainly at the UN level, but water at the domestic level and having national amendments to both legal and constitutional frameworks will be a powerful tool that we will increasingly use, building on the victory in Uruguay.
Are there private water companies in the cities of Uruguay right now?
Yes, and this was certainly the impetus for the right to water movement in Uruguay, was that there were some failed privatizations, and the people of Uruguay, you know, we work with Friends of the Earth Uruguay down there, we work with the Commission on the Right to Water, and these groups looked at the situation, saw that something needed to change, and just decided to take a very powerful and you know, dramatic move, and they were able to implement a mass strategy where one-tenth of the people, the voters in Uruguay, signed a petition that then put this question onto the constitutional ballot, onto the electoral ballot, and in the vote of October 31st, almost two-thirds of voters voted for the right to water, water being a fundamental human right, and this has resulted in the constitutional change.
How will this amendment in the Constitution of Uruguay be implemented?
There are a lot of questions around that. The new government is very sympathetic and ran on a platform of supporting this constitutional change. There are certainly powerful interests in the country still that are using many resources and fear tactics to try to get the government to back down from this, claiming that it will harm investment in the country, those types of arguments. They are up against the most powerful force, which is the will of the people, and we believe that in the end that we will triumph, and that the right to water as a fundamental human right will triumph.
Why do governments or municipalities decide to privatize their water systems? What are the arguments for it?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a difficult question, because people ask us that quite often. They go, you know, why would a government do something that it's obviously not in the interest of their citizens? And there's many reasons for it. I mean, they get their information from corporations lobbying them on this. There is an overarching ideology involved on privatization. I can't speak to specific cases, but I can tell you that our experience is that they're getting a lot of misinformation. They're being told that it'll cost less, when all the evidence points to the opposite. They're on one level, it makes their jobs easier, not having to manage these large utilities, giving them away to the private sector to manage. They can throw their hands up and say, you know, that's the company that's doing this, and they are then not subject to some of the ill will of people who aren't being served properly by these utilities. There's a whole host of reasons. They get short-term cash for selling it off. They're pressured in the South by structural adjustment, by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and regional development banks. They you have ideologically driven governments that are being told repeatedly that this will modernize your system. And at a more basic level, there isn't the awareness from the people And so that allows some of these things to go through without resistance. And that's our job, and that's our goal, is to work with the on-the-ground groups to raise that awareness and to let people know just what risk there is in handing over your systems to private, for-profit companies.
Can you expand on the role of international trade agreements on the privatization of water systems?
Yeah, the trade agreements really work with some of the other factors I've just talked about, because once you move to privatize or commodify your system, under the international trade agreements, you cannot then reappropriate it into the public system. You are forever stuck in a private sector control. And the reason for this is that these trade agreements are actually ideological documents that push trade only in one direction, and that's increased liberalization, as they call it. And so they want to open up markets. They want to continuously open up markets. So if you look at something like the General Agreement on Trade and Services, the GATS agreement, it's essentially a never-ending round of negotiation, where if a country like Canada in this round of negotiations protects healthcare, for instance, that doesn't mean to say that healthcare won't be on the round next, the next round, on the table next round. There's a continuous cycle of increasingly asking for further and further liberalization. So you can protect your water system today. You can protect your. Some countries may choose to protect their healthcare systems. This type of thing, but if this follows through to its logical end, all systems will be eventually opened up and open to the private interests.
Returning to Canada, are our water systems public or are they private?
Canada, I work internationally, but we do have a national water campaign, and Sarah Earhart is our national water campaigner, and she could speak more to this. But I'll just tell you that my experience of Canada is that people look to Canada to be kind of a model. We began certainly funding publicly these water utilities. There is a push by transnationals to increasingly access the water systems and control the water systems of northern countries, of wealthier countries like Canada. The reason is very, very simply that they've been burned in the south. They have lost money. They've been, you know, when Cochabamba took over its water system, when the peso fell in Argentina, and the company moved out, left lock, stock, and barrel. Those kind of political and economic vagaries and volatility, this is something that the companies are very afraid of. They would much rather work and control the water systems in northern countries, where things are much more stable as they see it and much more profitable, because there is more money in these countries to pay for these essential services. So I think that increasingly what we've seen from the transnationals is they rushed into the south. They expanded very quickly. Certainly their profits are very large globally, and their appetite for water systems is very large, but they are increasingly moving to the north. If you look at even in the south, what they're doing is they're not looking at rural systems. They're not looking at the poorest countries. They're not looking at giving access to the poorest people. What they look at is countries that are middle-income, areas of countries and cities that have enough income to pay for water, and certainly the north. And increasingly, we are already seeing that working with our governments, you know, this Martin government had a parliamentary secretary for public-private partnerships. Public-private partnerships are just code for privatization. And so when you have countries and governments pushing the privatization agenda, of course you're going to get companies that are knocking at the door and wanting to be involved in that and profit off of it.
Do you know of examples in Canada of privatization of water? Have they been met by success or failure?
Well, I think that for me, there is not one single example of a privatization success. Argentina was pointed to as a success of the neoliberal ideology and model. El Alto, Bolivia, was recently pointed out as a positive model by the companies and by the transnationals and by the World Bank and such. And these have crumbled. And for me, there is no singular success in the privatization or commodification of water. What we have instead is that you have snapshots where they can point to some positives. But in my experience, if you extrapolate and extend that, these systems come crumbling and fall down because they are inherently unsustainable. You cannot continue to take profit out of these systems and expect that the infrastructure remains sound. You cannot only extend the pipes into those suburbs and those communities that can pay and expect that the communities overall will benefit or that the region will benefit. You cannot commodify water and hand it over to industry and to large-scale agribusiness at neglect of poor users and human rights. You can't continue to do all those things and expect those systems to remain standing and to remain viable. So overall, I think that in Canada, Hamilton was pointed to, it was one of the larger scale privatizations, and it's been a resounding flop to the extent that it continuously flipped between companies. Companies just kept flipping the concession year after year. They got fined for dumping raw effluent into the lake. And in the end, the people of Hamilton, through their council, have just last year made a commitment to take that back into public hands. This has happened around the world. Atlanta did it. They took it back after failure by the private system. Manila's in the process of doing it. I mean, there are so many failures, and the only thing that the private companies or the World Bank or anyone pushing this say is that we've learned from our mistakes. We can do it better. We're being transparent. We're moving forward. We're learning. What we say is that you can't build upon something so fundamentally flawed. Nothing good can come of privatization. We need to strengthen our public systems, and that applies to countries like Canada as well.
For those interested in getting involved in the campaign for water as a human right internationally or locally, what do you recommend they do?
Well, I think certainly our website has a lot of information, www.canadians.org. On there is a petition where you can press Paul Martin and this government to reverse their stand blocking water as a human right internationally. What people must also do is also look to their own communities. And this means understanding where the water comes from, protecting watersheds, protecting upstream sources of water. I want to be very clear here that we cannot just view water singularly as a human right without risking this continued abuse. We need to look at it in a more holistic manner. We need to look at water in regards to protecting nature, protecting ecosystems. These are very important things to protect, to realizing water as a human right. So it has to be looked at from both aspects of it. Certainly, I think that if there is a privatization in your community, you need to be in there asking questions. You need to be getting information. There are also a number of good resources out there on the Internet. Public Citizen of the United States has a Water for All website. There's waterjustice.org, which is a more interactive website that we're part of that looks at alternatives to water privatization. There's a lot of information for people who are connected to the Internet. I think awareness is key. Mobilizing when there is a threat is key, and our government certainly needs to be pushed to reverse its stand on water as a human right.
Do you have any final comments?
Well, I think that this is about more than just water. This is about fundamentally how we organize our societies. It's how do we interact as a global community. It's how we interact with nature. There's so many aspects to looking at water, how we treat water, that I would really encourage people to get involved on this issue. Certainly, all the activist struggles that are out there, many of them come together in water. So if you look at, there are some people that are challenging the World Bank and other international financial institutions. Water is one of the key struggles there. People who are fighting the trade agreements and the undemocratic nature of those. Again, water and how water is treated in those trade agreements is of grave concern. People fighting the corporate control globally, water again, and the transnationals mostly coming out of Europe are key targets here, the Suez and the Vivendis, those kind of corporate organizations. I think that it gets to a more profound level of fundamental human rights, and what do we put, what is our worldview? If we cannot protect the right to water for everybody, regardless of their ability to pay, I think that we will have failed the generations coming after us. We need to look forward, how we manage our water resources, what we leave for the future, and how we distribute what is essentially a diminishing resource, and how we protect it at the core. These are all very important questions that are still unanswered, because there are very powerful forces that are trying to privatize and, again, commodify our water.
Thank you, Anil.
My pleasure.